From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College, this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Dina Sherhan.
And I'm Clara Izupidis.
This week on War News Radio, Unmanned War, we begin the first installment in a two-week special report on drone attacks. First, we hear about a history of modern warfare leading to the United States' increasing use of unmanned aerial vehicles.
Then, we speak to acclaimed robotics expert Peter W. Singer about the current status of drone use by the United States.
Finally, we look into the legal questions raised by these attacks.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
An assassin called Ahmed Wali Karzai, half-brother of Afghan President Hamid Karzai, at his home in Kandahar. Wali Karzai was regarded by many as the most powerful man in southern Afghanistan. Witnesses say that a member of Wali Karzai's own security team, Sardar Muhammad, undertook the attack. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the assassination, even though there is no prior evidence that Muhammad had any ties to the insurgency. Afghan and U.S. authorities have questioned the immediate implications of Karzai's death to the withdrawal of American troops beginning this month. Karzai's funeral was met with a series of bombing attacks across the country, most recent of which took place at a mosque in Kandahar during the Karzai Memorial Service. According to officials, that attack killed Hikmatullah Hikmat, head of the Provincial Ulama Council, along with three others. 13 more were wounded.
The United States has officially recognized the Libyan rebels who are fighting against current Libyan leader Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton stated that Gaddafi's government no longer has legitimate authority and that the United States would be joining 30 other countries in recognizing the Libyan rebel group, the Transitional National Council. The recognition would allow the United States to turn over previously frozen Libyan assets, which could be used to aid in their fight against Gaddafi.
French lawmakers voted recently to increase their nation's military intervention in Libya. Although France has been playing a key role in launching NATO-led strikes in Libya, the French government is growing impatient with its lack of progress and pushing towards a political solution with Muammar Gaddafi's forces. The French Foreign Minister Alain Juppé said that the Libyan leader is ready to leave power and that the Libyan regime has been sending messengers to Turkey, New York, and Paris to facilitate discussion of Gaddafi's exit.
A suicide bomber killed five French soldiers in Afghanistan on Wednesday, outside of a meeting between NATO officials and Afghan tribal leaders, just north of the capital in the Kapisa province. In addition to the casualties, four French soldiers and three Afghan civilians were seriously wounded during the bombing. The attack took place just one day after French President Nicolas Sarkozy returned to France from a visit to Afghanistan, where he had announced that France would withdraw 1,000 of its 4,000 troops by 2012.
Three coordinated bomb blasts disrupted the evening rush hour in Mumbai. The blasts occurred within few minutes of each other, witnesses said, killing at least 17 and injuring more than 100 people. No claims of responsibility followed the attacks, but officials speculate that Indian Mujahideen or armed Pakistani group Lashkar-e-Taiba could be responsible. India's Home Minister said that all groups hostile to India are being treated as possible suspects behind the attacks, as Indian police continued to search for clues.
Human Rights Watch is calling on the U.S. government to open an independent criminal investigation of former President George W. Bush and senior members of his staff. In a new 107-page report, Getting Away with Torture, the Bush Administration and Mistreatment of Detainees, the New York-based International Human Rights Agency accuses Bush and his administration of authorizing human rights abuses, including illegal CIA detentions and torture of detainees.
This is War News Radio. An Al-Qaeda lieutenant suspected for the USS Cole bombing was killed by a US Predator drone strike in Yemen in 2002. 7 years and many US drone strikes later, another attack killed an infamous Taliban leader. War News Radio's Ankita Kirtha takes a look at how unmanned warfare has become integral to the US military strategy in this brief history of modern warfare.
Some unmanned aerial vehicles, though as small and delicate as hummingbirds, are actually flying cameras. Others are bulkier. They shoot missiles and go by names like the Reaper. But such devices weren't dreamed up in a Hollywood studio to furnish fantasy landscapes. They're the stuff of modern combat, redefining warfare as we know it. In March, the Pentagon generated the Aircraft Procurement Plan, a 30-year scheme for buying and developing warcrafts. In it, the number of unmanned aerial vehicles in the U.S. arsenal is expected to double in the next 9 years. The report, alongside daily stories of airstrikes in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and beyond, indicates the growing presence of the technology in national defensive efforts. But while the escalation of drone use seems unique to the 21st century, experts view it as a logical stage, an essential chapter, in the ongoing post-modernization of war. Professor Douglas Kellner, Philosophy of Education Chair at UCLA, describes how technology is taking over.
The post-modernization of war revolution in military affairs involves the use of high tech in warfare, of computers and satellites in command and control systems, in surveillance and simulated battlefields and computer-directed high-tech precision weapons.
He believes that drones are an inevitable byproduct of this technical revolution.
It's the planes, the drones, the unmanned aircraft that are replacing soldiers and pilots as the instruments of war. In other words, it's the technology, the drones, that do the striking, that hit the targets, that are basically the primary unit of warfare. Although obviously there's people that are directing drones. They're in turn being directed by satellite technology and computers.
But drones aren't the only robotized instruments in battle. Mohammed Idris Ahmad, a Glasgow-based sociologist who's written articles about military technology, says that today's military efforts use unmanned devices of all forms.
It's also the type of bombs, the JDAMs, now guided by GPS. And then you have cruise missiles, again, satellite-guided. And then you have a lot of robotics that are being used on ground. You have automated bomb disposal machines. So you have all kinds of weapons that have been introduced into warfare, into battle, which in some ways, obviously, they have been really helpful to soldiers, as in they put a barrier between them and direct harm.
So how did we get here? The past is marked by inventive efforts to automate and robotize. In 350 BC, ancient Greek mathematician Archytas created a mechanical dove that he powered with steam. Then, when Nikola Tesla invented the radio-controlled motorboat in the 1900s, he revealed the military potential of unmanned devices. Kellner believes that the technical transformation and post-modernization of conflict began recently. During the Vietnam War, he says, the Pentagon developed the concept of an electronic battlefield made up of sensors to track the progress of Vietnamese troops. But these plans were thwarted when Vietnamese armies dug a series of undetectable tunnels all the way from Hanoi to the south of Vietnam. Then, tech warfare skyrocketed during the 1990s with cruise missiles, laser-guided weapons, computer systems, and target-detecting satellite systems.
It's really sort of the Gulf War of Bush 1 in 1991, where you have the first, really high-tech battlefield. And even there, although they claimed that it was high-tech precision weapons that were used, there was a lot of civilian casualties.
Kellner says those weapons may not have been as precise as was once claimed.
It's really only now, I think, in the last few years during the Obama administration that you have these high-tech drone attacks in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, more recently in Somalia and Yemen that really are precision high-tech weapons.
This rise of high-precision technology is accompanied by dramatic shifts in the conceptualization of war. According to Ahmad, the increasing disengagement brought about by drones is challenging fundamental notions of honor and valor.
If you're fighting a just war, if there's a notion of defending either your people, your tribe, your family is associated with it, so there's a certain virtue because you're sacrificing. So what this does, having the drones or some machines could do the killing without you ever facing any danger, is that it removes that idea of sacrifice or virtue from war.
So, for Ahmad, it is this remoteness of remote operations that defines postmodern conflicts.
Ultimately, it is a vicarious experience of warfare, and in a manner which we have never seen before, because in the past, war was a participatory experience. So it has created a useful distance. It has made war seem more bloodless and more exciting and almost like playing a video game.
Kellner discusses what might lie ahead in the evolving saga of the postmodern war.
It's an irony the way that U.S. ground troops have been used in Afghanistan and to some extent Iraq fighting old-fashioned kinds of guerrilla war, that I think we're going to see less and less in this, because on one hand there's a very heavy price in terms of U.S. troops, that thousands of troops have been killed in Afghanistan and Iraq.
He says that the effectiveness of ground warfare remains in question when the very terrain on which war is fought is changing.
So I think you're going to have an obsolescence of the traditional kind of military troops, and you're going to have a replacement by technology.
For War News Radio, I'm Anki Takrutha.
This is War News Radio. The evolution of modern warfare suggests that robotics are here to stay. But what is the current status of drone use by the U.S.? Eliana Biscard Church spoke with Peter Singer, director of the 21st Century Defense Initiative, senior fellow in foreign policy at the Brookings Institute, and author of Wired for War, The Robotics Revolution and Conflict in the 21st Century.
Testifying before Congress in March 2010, when the legality of drone attacks was in question, Peter W. Singer emphasized the rapid evolving use of robotics by the military and the CIA, and the challenges these technologies may bring, despite their obvious benefits. I caught up with Singer, an expert on 21st century defense issues who writes about robotics and war, to get the current story.
So again, thanks so much for your time. To begin, since you testified before Congress, how has the government's perception of drone warfare changed, and you know, how do we justify strikes on 6 countries now?
We're basically seeing a technology at a turning point. I think the best parallels for talking about unmanned systems, robotics today is a couple of ones. The Air Force describes that it's at a turning point equivalent to, say, 1918 with the airplane. We're using these systems more and more, but we're just now figuring out how to use them, where they're headed to next, some of the new legal and ethical concerns that are coming out of them. You know, so back in 1918, it was, hold it, we can use these things for bombing. That raises a lot of deep questions, not only on the tactics of war, but what does it mean to bomb a city? You know, what's righteous? What's legal? We're seeing the same sort of thing applying to unmanned systems today.
Right. So could you speak a little bit more to what the advantages and disadvantages are of drones?
Robotics are particularly used for jobs that are viewed as dull, dirty, or dangerous. The real one that has political weight is dangerous. Being able to send a system out and not having to worry about its pilot being killed or taken prisoner. That is both a positive. We've had, for example, thousands of soldiers' lives saved by robotics that, for example, have been able to find roadside bombs, or we've been able to carry out, you know, well over 200 airstrike missions in places like Pakistan and not have to worry about a human pilot, an American, being killed or captured. Now, the flip side of this advantage is that some worry that it's changing the decision-making that goes into war, that if you don't have to worry about some of these issues, you may be lowering the cost of war and not contemplating the decision to go into war with the same level of seriousness. Indeed, it may be even changing the definition of war. We could see this in two recent examples. In Pakistan, again, we've carried out more than 200 airstrikes there. By any past measure, this is the equivalent of a war. Or we see the current debate between the President and Congress right now over the Libya operations. And one of the things that the President said was, you know, this is not a war. One of his reasons was because we're not sending some pilots into harm's way in the missions that are most dangerous. We're just sending Predator class systems. So it's changing the context of how we talk about war, maybe even the definition of war itself.
Right. And you kind of preceded one of my other questions, but it seems so confusing, mainly with who is responsible for most of the strikes. There's a more overt operation from the military, but then there's a more covert plan from the CIA. How does those two kind of different campaigns impact overall our use of drones, but also then how the public gets their information?
Exactly. We are talking about the same technology, but a wide set of users of it. And some raise different and arguably more difficult questions than others. So in my mind, as an example, the military uses of this technology in places like Afghanistan is far less problematic than, say, the CIA's use of it in places like Pakistan or Yemen or Somalia. And really it comes down to a question not so much of the technology itself, but the people behind it, the rules and structures behind it. So military use of it means that it falls within a established chain of command. You have established legal codes. Now, we can argue about are the rules always followed or the like, but the point is there's a transparency there. By comparison, when you've got civilian intelligence agencies that are supposed to be operating covertly, means they're responding to very different pressures. The people deciding the legality, the rules of engagement questions are not military JAG officers who spent their entire career training for this. They're civilian general counsels at that agency. It means they have a very different training package. Unlike the overt military way of dealing it, when you're talking about a covert operation, we don't even acknowledge that the missions themselves have happened, let alone if and when they go awry. And so it's just far more problematic.
Yeah, it's pretty complicated. We see with a lot of questions.
Yeah, none of this is simple. I mean, people want to, you know, sort of, you know, right and wrong, yes or no, use them or don't use them. I mean, it's a lot like that parallel of the computer back in 1980. It's like saying, you know, are computers good or bad? You know, no. What are some of the issues of using computers? I mean, that's what we're talking about here.
And so, obviously, computers have become integral to society. So, do you see the parallel continuing? And, like, you know, what's the future of warfare, as briefly as possible? Drones are going to continue to be used?
At the start of this, you know, in 2003, we were using a handful of them. Today, we've got over 7,000 in the U.S. military inventory alone. We've got 44 other nations besides the U.S. using them.
Do you think that'll open up for more kind of pseudo-wars, like we have things going on in Yemen and Somalia?
I think that's clearly where we're headed for counterterrorism missions in the future. And that is both an aspect of the technology itself, but also a reaction by the American body politic. We're seeing a very different style of responding to the threat of terrorism in failed states. It's using proxies and using airstrikes, particularly from unmanned systems. That seems to be the new mode.
Well, you've left us much food for thought. Thanks so much again for your time. For War News Radio, I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
This is War News Radio. It is clear that drone strikes in Pakistan have increased under President Obama's administration. The surge in the number of attacks has been accompanied by an increase in legal questions that the United States has barely begun to address. Stuart Russell looks into the law with expert arguments for and against the use of drone strikes.
The stakes are high when determining the legality of drone strikes. Mary Ellen O'Connell, a professor of international law at Notre Dame Law School, explains.
You know, you can see the attraction of drone attacks to the U.S. because we're losing young men and women every week in Afghanistan. We don't lose any of our own people with drone strikes. I want to save our people, but I also don't want to be the country that kills when there's no legal or moral right to do so.
Drones, or unmanned aerial vehicles, are obviously an attractive option for the United States military. However, there is disagreement as to whether or not drone attacks in Pakistan actually comply with the combination of treaties that define international law. The Obama administration maintains that its actions are following all rules of war and all international guidelines. Critics say that drone strikes violate international laws about the use of force, and that there are better ways to pursue terrorists. The central question remains, is the United States in an armed conflict or at war with Al-Qaeda? State Department legal advisor Harold Koh explained the Obama administration's opinion during a March 25, 2010 speech to the American Society of International Law.
As recent events have shown, Al-Qaeda has not abandoned its intent to attack the United States. Indeed, it continues to attack us. And thus, in this ongoing armed conflict, the U.S. has the authority under international law and the responsibility to its citizens to use force, including lethal force, to defend itself, including by targeting persons such as high-level Al-Qaeda leaders who are planning attacks.
University of Michigan law professor Steve Ratner explains the armed conflict distinction gives the Obama administration far-reaching powers, allowing them to justify targeted killings of terrorists using drones.
If you are operating in an armed conflict situation, then you are allowed to kill an enemy combatant without any questions. You're allowed to kill them when they're sleeping, you're allowed to kill them when they're in the bathroom, you're allowed to kill them, you know, as long as the war is going on, and you don't really have to try to arrest them at all.
O'Connell, however, disagrees. She believes that the United States is not in an armed conflict with Al-Qaeda. Instead, she thinks that the United States is involved in an international law enforcement effort in which Al-Qaeda terrorists are not combatants, but international criminals, no different from members of the mafia or drug cartels.
There are two things you look into. Has Pakistan attacked the United States? Then we could respond in self-defense. That hasn't happened, so we're not responding in self-defense. We have no right to use military force in Pakistan or Yemen, arguing self-defense. So the next question is there armed conflict going on in those countries in which the governments have asked us to come in and help them in solidarity to fight, as we're doing in Afghanistan right now? So Hamid Karzai has asked the U.S. to come into Afghanistan and help him suppress a civil war. Well, Pakistan hasn't asked us to do that either.
Because she does not think that there is an ongoing armed conflict, O'Connell believes that drone strikes violate international law. She counters remarks that Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta made when he was director of the CIA. While Panetta said that drone strikes are the only game in town, O'Connell claims that old-fashioned police work would be more effective.
It's not the only game in town. The police could come up to those persons. We've long handled the problem of terrorism through criminal justice methods, and that's what counterterrorism experts and various studies show is the right way to handle a problem of militant or violent organized groups like the ones in Pakistan.
In this discussion, it is important to note the definition of war or armed conflict, because this is where much of the controversy lies. According to Ratner, international law recognizes two kinds of war: interstate war, an armed conflict between two states, and civil war, an armed conflict between a state and a non-state actor, such as a rebel group. Since Al-Qaeda is a transnational non-state actor not limited to one specific country, some experts, such as O'Connell, believe the United States needs to be involved in more international police work. Ratner explains that the United States fight against Al-Qaeda does not fit the two normal classifications.
What we have here is really neither. It's not state to state, and it's not a civil war in the sense that it's confined to one state and between the government and that state. The idea of a conflict between the United States and Al-Qaeda is a new sort of claim in international law. There are some states and some NGOs that simply reject the concept at all that there is such a thing as a conflict between the United States and a transnational non-state actor. And so therefore, the U.S. really should be limited to trying to arrest people.
Another important element in this debate is whether or not the Pakistani government has consented to the drone strikes on its soil. Peter Spiro, a professor of international law at Temple Law School, notes that this is a highly debated point.
This is one of the variables. I think there have been points at which Pakistan has consented to drone attacks. It may do so in a non-public fashion, and therefore it's not clear, it may not be clear from the public's perspective whether or not Pakistan has consented to these attacks. And so that just adds another layer of complication here.
Despite the confusion regarding Pakistan's position, Spear notes that it may actually be irrelevant. Some say that the United States could still conduct drone attacks without explicit Pakistani consent.
Because that Pakistan withdraws its consent to these attacks, then Pakistan's sovereignty becomes a part of the legal mix. In the same way that it did, for instance, with respect to the operation that resulted in the killing of Osama bin Laden. There is a test under which such operations can be justified, notwithstanding the lack of consent from a territorial government. And that here the question becomes one of whether Pakistan is either unwilling or unable to take action against these adversary forces.
Ratner agrees, noting that even if Pakistan does not consent, there is a theory that drone attacks may still be legal. This, however, is assuming that the United States is operating in an armed conflict.
The idea would be that if a state is the victim of an armed attack or is under continued threat of armed attack from a non-state actor like a transnational terrorist group, that it has a right to respond against that transnational terrorist group wherever it is located, subject to the caveat that the government of that state where it's located should be given every opportunity to try to suppress the group itself.
Ratner says that if this does not happen, the so-called victim state could take matters into its own hands.
So under that sort of theory, what you would say is that because Pakistan has been unable to suppress the work of al-Qaeda in its territory, that the United States, therefore, as under its right of self-defense, is allowed to respond.
It is clear that no consensus has been reached for many of the legal questions in the drone issue. Regardless, Spiro does not believe they'll disappear anytime soon.
Although there have been questions raised about the legality of such attacks, the strategic advantage of these attacks is so great that it would require really an about-face on the part really of the world community with respect to their use. So I think that these drones are likely to be the weapon of choice going forward.
For now, it's not clear how the legal debate will affect strategy. The Obama administration believes there are great political and strategic benefits to using drones, and there is no sign use will end in the foreseeable future. For War News Radio, I'm Stuart Russell.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Eliana Biscard Church, Stuart Russell, Anki Takurtha, and Sarah Dwider. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Clara Izupitis.
And I'm Dina Sherham. Until next time, thanks for listening.